Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, legislative leaders break the stalemate that has been holding up the budget for over a year. It means state employee and teacher pay raises are closer to being realized. What's more, House Speaker Destin Hall says the state can brag about teacher pay.
It will take starting teachers to number one in the South.
With the ink still wet on her resignation, the jockeying for position to replace Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles is underway, while the mayor calls her decision to step down
probably the most difficult thing that I've ever had to do.
Charlotte City Council pulls its support for the I-77 toll lanes. What happens now? Council also brings data centers under closer scrutiny and approves 10 red light cameras. Plus, after a difficult budget session, the CMS School Board approves the budget that they will send to the county. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is WFAE education reporter James Farrell. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here.
Morning.
So after an impasse lasting more than a year, all of the details of the state budget, House Speaker Destin Hall and Senate Leader Phil Berger emerged this week to say the logjam had been broken.
Both of our chambers have reached largely an agreement on the big issues, and I'm confident that we'll be able to get a comprehensive budget done relatively soon.
This is a starting point. There's still a lot that will need to be decided and discussed between the two chambers, but this agreement sets out a good framework for us to move forward.
So, Ben, after all this time, why now? What broke the logjam?
Well, I think a lot of this has been focused on sort of tax decreases over the next several years and the rate at which we accelerate them. But I think you heard Phil Berger say right there, this is a framework. A lot of people, including the governor, I think, have expressed skepticism that this is actually going to happen. And Phil Berger even alluded to it right there, that this is the very early beginning stages of happening. But at least at this point, it seems like they have some common agreement when it comes to things like pay raises for state workers and teacher pay and those tax decreases as well. So at least it seems like they have some common ground to move forward with.
Well, you anticipated my next question, because why come to the podium and announce the framework if there's no budget yet and they still have all these details to hammer out? And the big question is, could they reach yet another impasse in this process?
Absolutely. I think a lot of people are sort of banking on that happening. I do also think that they want to show and express a confidence that they can have a functional budget process. I mean, North Carolina has been criticized across the country for not being able to get this done for 3 years now. And you have, you know, inflation that continues to go up. You have people who deserve pay raises that are not getting them. You want to have, no matter how small you want a state government, Republicans want it to be always be smaller. You still need it to have a functional government. And a lot of people were getting to the point of thinking, okay, are we functioning if we're not getting an updated budget year to year?
The ones that we keep referring to who have been suffering most from this, I guess, are the teachers and the state employees who have been waiting now for a while, a long time, for the promised raises that have been part of the budget. And House Speaker Destin Hall announced that the budget would, in fact, maintain those promised pay hikes.
This budget includes 3% average raise, but there's a greater raises for certain areas of state government where the need is more great.
The 3% is for state employees. Law enforcement may receive raises between 10 and 20%, depending on the agency they work for. And Hall said that teachers can expect the largest pay raise since 2006.
The average teacher pay raise in our budget will be 8%. It will take starting teachers to number one in the South when you're including the local supplement, but also taking care of veteran teachers as well, and giving increases all across the salary schedule for teachers.
James, is that a surprise that starting teachers will be paid at the highest level in the South?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that he says the highest level in the South, but he also adds the caveat when you factor in county supplements. And that's important because I think a lot of county leaders would make the argument that the state is the one that should be setting the competitive pay, and the supplement is really supposed to adjust for cost of living locally. So I think that could be a point of contention going forward too. I also just think it's noteworthy that, you know, the starting teachers are the focus here, which makes sense because we've had recruitment issues in North Carolina, but it's also been such a contentious talking point about veteran teachers and the fact that the pay scale freezes at year 15. They don't get a raise for 10 years. From what we've seen so far, that appears that would still be the case. Those teachers would get a raise, but there's no raises after that point. So I think that's going to continue to be a point of discussion. I think that's a little surprising that that didn't get looked at more. There are some bonuses that we have to hear more about. There's not a lot of details about those bonuses. But I think that's something that's surprising that we didn't see that issue hammered out.
It has been a bone of contention for quite a while with veteran teachers who go back and get higher degrees as they go through their careers, and they're not being compensated for it. And I'm curious, I know that attracting new teachers into the fold is important, but so is maintaining them. Why can you think of a reason they would not include more raises for veteran teachers?
Yeah, I think part of it is just the factor of recruitment. We have a lot of teacher vacancies in the state. So I think the idea of trying to compete with bringing people over and having them come here from places like South Carolina that have historically had higher teacher pay, I think that's probably the driving factor behind it. But to your point, Mike, I mean, I think educators would note that one of the most important things that you could have is an experienced teacher, a qualified teacher in the classroom. So losing veteran teachers is a problem as well. Retention is a problem as well, and something I think still needs to be hammered out.
So teacher raises, as we've said, will average around 8%. But these raises, when they come through, will not be retroactive to when the budget should have been passed. Is that a surprise?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are surprised by that. I know the North Carolina Association of Educators, they put out a statement criticizing this. They called the whole thing smoke and mirrors. And that was one of the issues they brought up, was the lack of back pay. Also, the fact that, you know, there's inflation and higher healthcare costs. And teachers spend a lot of money out of pocket for things in the classroom, saying that this wasn't enough, basically. So I definitely think the back pay definitely ruffled some feathers, too.
And Ben, there are also bonuses in this budget for some state employees of between $1,000 to $1,750. Instead of making the raises retroactive, they'll give them a one-time bonus. Does that include teachers?
Teachers would also get bonuses. It would depend on again, what their experience level versus veterans teachers. So it sort of goes back to the same problem. But yeah, so teachers would be included. State workers would be included. All of this sort of buoyed by the tax cuts we mentioned earlier, gradually going down over the next several years.
So starting pay for new teachers will increase to $48,000. The state portion of their pay will increase to $48,000. Governor Stein recommended $50,000. The difference doesn't sound that extreme, but I believe both these figures, correct me if I'm wrong, are below the cost of living in Charlotte with this raise. And when you add in the county supplement, will they breach that mark? Will they have essentially a living wage? James.
I'd have to look at the numbers specifically. I think so. I think based off of the supplement here in Mecklenburg County, it would get them to the living wage in Mecklenburg County, because I think the living wage is like $55,000 here. I might be wrong on that. But my understanding is I think it will definitely help.
So Destin Hall also referenced taking care of veteran teachers, we've been talking about here. They've traditionally had complaints that those teachers are being shortchanged as more significant raises have been going to beginning teachers. That's not addressed in this budget. Retired state employees will also receive a one-time 2.5% cost of living bonus in their pension. Ben, the rate of inflation is 3.8%. Will that one-time bonus of 2.5 be viewed positively?
I mean, I think who doesn't like a bonus, but I mean, at the same time, does it compensate for inflation? Absolutely. Nowhere close to that. But and certainly you got to say a lot of this frustration is pent up, not just from the last year, but from the last 3 years. And the teachers union made that same point that they're looking to compensate not just from the last year, but from several years of not having a budget, and that to catch up for what has been a lot of inflation in that time period, it is substantial and goes way beyond some of the percentages and margins we're talking about.
Part of the reason it's taken so long to pass this budget, which is over a year late, were the disagreements between House and Senate Republicans over what to do about scheduled tax cuts. You've already referenced this, Ben. The House wanted to delay the cut. Senate Leader Phil Berger wanted to stick with the plan.
We need to make sure that that promise to the taxpayers was kept, which this agreement does.
So what does the agreement do?
So it would take them basically from 3.99 down to 3.49%, I think, over the next couple of years, with a target of eventually going down to 2.99%, I think, in 7 or 8 years, eventually bottoming out at just under 2.5. But I think there are certain triggers that would have to happen before we got to that point.
And Berger wanted the tax reductions pegged to a schedule. Hall wanted them adjusted based on the state's total revenue, which I think is smart, but who knows? Democrats have long feared that these cuts would cause the state to face a fiscal cliff. So Speaker Hall got the victory here. Would that be correct?
He did. He worried, and the House argued this whole time that they were just too aggressive, considering what they were expecting, some economic headwinds. So yeah, Destin Hall got the victory on this one.
Is that an indication of the lame duck power of Phil Berger, or is that or something else at play here, just another compromise?
I think some would certainly view it that way. I'm not sure that I would say that, but yeah, for sure. Some people would say that if this happened again, I think you could certainly say that.
So personal income tax rates, as you said, are scheduled to drop from 3.99 to 3.49% for the next 2 years, then be reduced to 2.99% by 2033 and 2.49% after that, depending on revenue triggers now. But the corporate tax rate reduction remains on track. What's the plan there?
I'd have to actually pull up the numbers to see what the changes are there, but I think it's not substantial compared to what you're talking about when it comes to the individual rate.
So this is a Republican-controlled General Assembly and Republican budget. We had Mecklenburg District 41 Senator Democrat Caleb Tedros on the program this week. He says Democrats were essentially shut out of these budget discussions.
Traditionally, this is dropped on Senate Democrats' office maybe the night before, if we're lucky. And so just explain how things work. If you are the minority, in this instance, the super minority, the last go-round in budget discussions, we got it, I believe, at Monday at 5 p.m., and then that Tuesday morning is when the budget was read in committee.
I don't think anybody on this panel is old enough to remember when Democrats were in control, but I'm going to ask, did the Democrats do the same thing to Republicans when they ran the place? Nobody knows.
You certainly hear that accusation. just like when it happens when we talk about redistricting, Republicans will be the first one to say, oh, Democrats did the same thing. So, yes, they say the same thing happened.
Meanwhile, both the House and Senate agreed to pass bills putting a pair of tax-related amendments on November's general election ballot. The Senate agreed to pass the House-proposed constitutional amendment that would cap the state's personal income tax rate at 3.5%. And Democratic Senator Jay Chaudhry believes that such a cap would harm the state's ability to fund education and other essential services.
It permanently handcuffs the General Assembly's responsibility for passing fiscally sound, responsible budgets going into the future.
And Governor Stein agrees. He says this proposed constitutional amendment would put the state, quote, in a financial straitjacket that could wreak havoc on our public schools and on public safety. We don't have time to talk about this because we're coming up to a break, but public schools are already considered by many to be underfunded, and there have been cries for greater public safety measures to be put into effect, which of course requires money, and many of those cries are coming from Republicans. So when we come back, somebody tell me why putting a cap on that would enable them to fund what they want to see happen here. We'll do that when we come back. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. As part of the middle school Think Lab curriculum, students engage in hands-on, project-based learning focused on real-world problems. Information at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on listener-funded WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. Alexandria Sands is with us. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC TV. We were talking just before the break about the budget and about these two constitutional amendments that they have proposed for the November ballot that we would vote on, one of which would cap the state personal income tax rate at 3.5%. It's scheduled to go below that, but it couldn't go any higher than that if the cap comes through. And Democrats believe that would strap public schools and underfund things like public safety and law enforcement. And law enforcement and public safety is a big concern of Republican lawmakers. Am I missing something here? Why would you put a cap on what funds better protection if you want more protection?
I don't think this is honestly about public safety or education or even honestly budget or spending. I think this is about reading the writing on the wall as Republicans and future-proofing, leaving your mark, getting ready for a time, whether it's 2 years from now or 5 years from now, when Democrats are going to be in control again, and trying to secure your legacy now as Republicans and make sure that, as they see it, tax and spend liberals don't come in and undo all the progress they see they've made in the last 12 years. So by doing this, passing constitutional amendments, they're guaranteeing their legacy moving forward at a time when Democrats might be back in control.
Have you looked at the maps, the election district maps yet? That's a long shot. The Senate also agreed to pass a House proposal to add a constitutional amendment to the fall ballot, allowing the General Assembly to cap the property tax rate for local governments. And some of those governments, including Mecklenburg County and the county manager Mike Bryan, has warned that this will hurt local governments' abilities to fund necessary expenses. Why is the General Assembly getting involved in this? And has there been a hue and cry from citizens about them feeling fleeced by property taxes? What's driving this? Nobody knows. I've stumped the panel.
Well, I would honestly say, let's be honest, a lot of citizens might not be fully aware of this since it's still in the early stages. I would say it still goes back to the same thing before. It's Republicans trying to make sure that they have control of these situations and cities, in their view, spend recklessly and protecting sort of the tax base and the taxpayers from what they say cities that are out of control in their spending as they view it.
Okay. We spent a lot of time last week on this program, for obvious reasons, talking about the fact that longtime mayor of Charlotte, Vi Lyles, had announced in a surprise that she would resign from office at the end of June. This week, she spoke about that decision publicly, I think for the first time, at the council meeting, and had this to say.
I'm just so grateful for the number of people that have been so supportive of me making a decision that was probably the most difficult thing that I've ever had to do.
Alex, do we know any more today than we did last week about why she made that decision, especially so soon after the election?
No, nothing new. I mean, Mayor Lyles made those comments at the beginning of the meeting Monday, which has been referred to as a marathon meeting. I think it went on for 6 hours. So you look at that, you look at her reasoning being, I want to spend more time with her grandchildren. I think it makes a little bit of a fair argument. There has been a little bit more reporting on just her attendance at meetings dropping. I think the Observer said it went from 92% attendance rate in her first term to now it's at 61% so far in her fifth term. So whether it's burnout that's happening or she just wants to spend time with her grandchildren, that could be the real reason. But
okay. So nature abhors a vacuum, and evidently so do politicians, because they are jockeying for position to fill her shoes on an interim basis. Charlotte has a weak mayor system. The mayor is really a moral leader, a figurehead. She only votes on council to break ties. It is also, even though it's a part-time job, it is also a full-time job, at least the way Mayor Lyles and Pat McCrory have approached the job. Why is it attractive, then, to people in the world of politics? Ryan, any theories as to that?
Everybody you know, that's job. That's a question. Yeah, that's actually a question that I've always had. And when I see these, when I see folks who are already on council, basically what you're doing is giving up your vote. Unless you're a tiebreaker, you don't have a vote as mayor in the city. But I think it's one of those, you know, it's hard to be a politician without a certain amount of ego. And it's one of those things to be seen as you're running the city. you get to sort of go to all the flashy gigs and be the face of the city publicly, as opposed to sort of working in the on the grind and sort of behind the scenes and doing all this stuff that is even less pay, but still a full-time job, as many of the council members will tell you. So I don't want to throw, you know, blame people for being egomaniacs by any mean. I just mean, you know, that could be one of the explanations of people just want that bigger title.
Mayor Lyles came to power in 2017 by upsetting a member of her own party, the then incumbent Mayor Jennifer Roberts, and Roberts has now offered to serve unpaid in that position. She's also pledged not to run again in 2027, but in a statement added, quote, "I did not foresee this happening in my career path, but so many people in the community have asked me to offer my services as interim mayor that I feel called to do so." And she noted it would be a seamless and fairly quick transition. I think she still has the keys to the office in her purse. Does the current council choose the interim mayor? Is that the course of action here?
And yes, but you have to go through an application process.
Right.
Jennifer Roberts had sent that email to all the council members, and she sort of mentioned, like, and if you want me to apply as well, I can do that. And she just got a sort of very short, succinct email back from Councilmember Mayfield, who said, yes, you will apply like everyone else. Thanks for this long rambling. She didn't say thanks for the long rambling email, but that's sort of the message of, like, wow, thanks for letting us know all this, but you'll just have to apply like everyone else, and we'll see what happens from there.
So it has to be somebody from Mayor Lyles' party. Mayor Lyles is a Democrat. Roberts checks that box. How popular is she by members of council? Because I don't think anybody on council really wants this job, do they? Because it seems to me that you lose your vote and you may not get reelected in 2027. And you may have, do you have to pledge not to run if you take this job?
Yeah, I think you're being way too logical about this, Mike Collins. I think almost everybody up there on the dais wants the job. Now, we all question why somebody would, but for whatever reason, I think a lot of them do. And so I think the general idea here is they want to have somebody there, as twisted as the logic is, they want somebody there who has no interest in having the job whatsoever, so that it's not a threat to any of them who plan on actually running for it. So if they can find the person who's the most clued in and most sort of in the know about how things run, but the least personally invested, I don't know if that unicorn exists, but that's sort of what they're looking for.
But so far it has been crickets to Robert's response, and I haven't heard any other names from the council members thrown out. So I think they're all still kind of holding out to hope that they can become the appointee to fulfill their own ambitions. But we're definitely seeing also the public, we'll get to it, but the public pressure is ramping up as well. And that's going to play a huge factor into this.
And to answer your early question, Mike, I don't think they've outwardly stated that there needs to be a pledge that you won't be running in 2027, but that sort of is the implication. Then again, they always say that, and then someone will throw their hat back in. Edwin Peacock had made a promise when he became a interim District 6 rep that he wasn't going to run. And then as soon as the election came up, he was like, well, I'm going to run at large. So that's different. So it's always just sort of the political gaming in the background.
But there's no legal framework that says you can't run again. That it would be a promise that you can't be held to.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
And I also think we should note, like, Jennifer Roberts did consider running in 2025, and she ultimately said that she wouldn't because her reasoning was that she had other commitments. So this could be a good way to just really quickly get a little mayor role in there, and to because that's something that she wanted to do, but she just felt like she didn't have the time to do the full term.
Meanwhile, Corinne Mack, the president of the Mecklenburg chapter of the NAACP, has called for the interim mayor to be Black. In a Facebook post, Mack wrote, quote, "It is seriously disturbing for white folks to be lobbying to be interim mayor. If the city council votes a non-Black person in as interim mayor again, voters will hold you accountable next year." Evidently, the response to that post has been mixed, but she referenced some of the maneuvers happening in the state legislature with redistricting and also with the essential gutting of the Voting Rights Act by the United States Supreme Court among her reasons for making the call, and added, "We are in a critical time." I'm not sure I have a question here, but is she right?
I mean, Lyles was elected as a Democrat, so one of the requirements is that you would be a Democrat. But if you're looking back at 2017, where Mayor Lyles beat Jennifer Roberts, and this comment from Mac might be stemming a little bit. She said it's not stemming from Jennifer Roberts throwing her name in, but it might be stemming from that a little bit. You could argue that Lyles, a part of the reason she was elected is because she was representing the Black population in Charlotte. So I think it's a fair argument to say we want to make sure that we honor that commitment. If people went and they voted for Black representation, that's followed through with. I think seriously disturbing might have been strong wording, but I do understand her point.
Well, she also always been sort of a background concern, especially obviously the Black Political Caucus, because that's why they were formed to keep and hold Black political representation. But I just remember being at a mayoral campaign event in the Excelsior Club in like 2014 or 15, it was after Patrick Cannon's resignation. And some of the folks there who are background organizers, not candidates themselves, were really concerned at that point that people were going to see this as sort of a blown chance by a Black mayor. And mm-hmm. they wanted to not let that sort of representation slip and really were concerned with getting a Black mayor back in that chair. So, you know, this is a decade later. It's always going to be sort of there for front and center for folks who, especially at this time when around the country, Black representation is being stripped.
Ben.
Yeah, I spoke to Corinne Mack about that precisely and asked her about that statement. And she pointed out that in those past examples, both with Patsy Kinsey and Dan Klotfelter, who were picked to be interim mayors, that she supported those candidacies. Now she sees it's different because, as you were alluded to, the gutting of the Voting Rights Act and redistricting happening. She says now 2026 is a different time.
And she has suggested that former Charlotte mayor and former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox might be a candidate for that. Has he said anything about wanting to come back as an interim mayor?
No. He was just here for an event the night before with Mayor Lyles, the night before she retired. So he might have had to jump on that info, but he's teaching at Harvard. I've not heard anything from him that would signify that he's ready to take that part-time or short tenure
right
to finish it off. But that would be quite the news.
Alex, you used the word stunning to describe Charlotte City Council's vote to rescind support of the I-77 South toll lane project. This was a 6-5 decision, very close. Who pushed the boulder over that hill? Who said, yes, I don't want to, we want to stop this? Do you know?
Yeah, it was late Monday night after Charlotte City Council had already passed a resolution about I-77. And it was a pretty soft vote in the resolution. It just said that they wanted NCDOT to pause and they wanted to have an independent third party come in and evaluate some other options instead of toll lanes. So after that passed, Renee Johnson decided to put forth another motion, which I guess kind of cancels out the resolution, but this motion said that they wanted to withdraw support. And it's a little bit complicated because what they're technically withdrawing support for is their vote in 2024 to go to the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization and say they were okay with a private developer being a part of the project. So to go to this organization and to take away that vote, we need to also see if the county and the other towns agree to take away that vote. And then if we take away that vote, NCDOT will then probably say, well, we cannot do this without a private developer. Therefore, the project is canceled. And that seems to be the route that we're going down.
Let me ask a question that I've asked 1,000 times before. If the state has said no further highway construction will take place in North Carolina unless it is attached to a toll road. Okay, if this is such a great idea, why doesn't the state build the toll road and run it and collect the money? Why bring in a third party?
I do not know the answer to that question. Does anybody else on the panel
nobody
want to
does.
Take that one?
So Council Member Renee Johnson said, we're removing our support until further independent analysis and changes and community outreach are done to our satisfaction. Wasn't that done prior to NCDOT unveiling the original plan? And hasn't citizen input been taking place during this 90-day pause that DOT recently took because of community tensions over this plan?
The narrative that I feel like has emerged is all the local leaders are becoming frustrated because they keep saying we know something needs to be done, but NCDOT just keeps moving forward with the idea of toll lanes, and they have not at this point studied any other options or presented any other options.
Why is this a surprise when the state has made this perfectly clear for years? It will be a toll lane if we do anything.
Yeah, I think that's a good question, and I think it's because of the opposite. I mean, it goes back, we've known about this project for years, but it all goes back to when the first maps came out that showed all the homes being bulldozed over. And NCDOT has done work to reduce the number of homes that will be displaced. But now there's so much opposition that has come out to this that they have to, you know, respond to that response. And they have so many people, so many of their constituents telling them to change this project. And then you also have these tolls in the north that people don't like. So I think that as the project has moved along, just all this opposition has grown. It's getting more publicity. More people are aware of it. And I think that's a fair argument for NCDOT to say, maybe you guys, it's too late. And I know you guys are hearing a lot now from your constituents, but maybe you guys should have started this before.
Ryan?
And I think playing a role in this sort of shocker of a vote was what we just talked about in the mayoral race. And people, this is a perfect opportunity and timing for citizens to be speaking out, because no mayoral candidate, and to answer your earlier question, I think the turnover vote was Malcolm Graham, the one that nobody expected to vote for this rescission. And maybe it's because of he doesn't want to be running for mayor for a full year with that floating over his head as being one of the people who voted to keep this project going when everyone in the community seems to be screaming to stop it. So I just think that you know, that whole mayoral aspect really played a part in both this and other topics that we'll talk about later with the data centers. People are making votes based on community input.
Charlotte City Council is not the only entity that has said no to this project. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about that. And there's a little more to talk about with regard to toll lanes. And then we'll move on to the data centers you just referred to and the fact that red light cameras may be on their way back and CMS passed a budget. Talk about that too. It's Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Hence, James Farrell is here. He's our education reporter for WFAE News. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Ben Ryan Pitkin is founder and editor of Queen City Nerve, and Alexandria Sands reports for Axios Charlotte. So we've been talking about these toll lanes and the city council's rescinding of their permission to go forth with this. Mecklenburg County also rejected the plan over concerns about the tolls on the northern stretch of I-77, along with Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization members in Cornelius, Davidson, Huntersville, Marvin, Matthews, Weddington, and the Metropolitan Transit Commission. Doesn't that essentially mean there is no support anywhere for these toll lanes? Ryan?
Sure. NCDOT. But no, I don't know of anyone in the local municipalities who are really gunning for this. There may be representatives hidden throughout. I think Alex might have an idea of what elected officials are supporting it. It's not a very loud group.
Alex?
Yeah, I think, it's the business community that's really, they're starting to come out more now. I'm hearing more from them than I was before, now that it's becoming a little bit more likely that this project could be killed. I'm starting to notice the Regional Business Alliance is for this project. The real estate industry is for this project. People that want growth and they recognize that this interstate is an economic driver are going to start coming out and pushing
And clearly something has to happen. And in the discussions that led up to this, we were told that if toll lanes were not part of this, if the state had to fund this, it would not take place in our lifetimes. That the only way to do it expediently was with tolls. And that seems to be where the objection to all this is coming from local elected officials, but the real bugaboo for many citizens was the fact it was going to cut into West Side neighborhoods. They didn't want the noise pollution, the air pollution, the sight pollution if it was an elevated highway. And there was really no way around this because something has to be done to I-77 because it's a logjam many, many hours of every single day of the week. So why aren't those concerns part of the reason that they said no to this, Ben, at City Council?
Well, I think that's sort of the problem here is that we went from a slow but nuanced approach with the DOT of trying to tweak some of these changes, and that was actually happening slower than a lot of people wanted, but it was happening. And so I think now Ed Driggs will tell you, if we move forward this and the CRPTO, if they vote against it and the DOT kills this, it's done. There's no going back. There's no coming back and revisiting. There's no more tweaking. It is done. We are stuck with 77 the way it is in our lifetimes.
Yeah. And he said, you can't stop this, kill it, and then expect to restart it in a couple of years. The $600 million the state's putting toward this project will be gone. And he reminded fellow council members, the project requires a partnership between the state and a private company, which he referred to as P3.
None of this happens, right? If there is no P3, NCDOT is not going to see any basis for engaging in discussions about any of these things.
Of course, Driggs is worried about damaging relationships, but Councilmember Renee Johnson pushed back on that idea.
I don't think saying no should be a termination or suspension of a partnership. It's our job to represent our citizens, and this is what our citizens are saying.
She may be right, but Ben, what's the reality here?
I mean, I think DOT would argue, sure. And the time and place was years ago, not now. We've already have a legal arrangement. We've already agreed. We've gotten buy-in from our regional partners. This is the way we're moving forward. And we are tweaking it according to what you and the citizens want. And now you, the city, are completely backtracking on something you agreed to years ago.
Yeah. So NCDOT has issued a statement that says that, quote, other municipalities in addition to Charlotte need to weigh in, but that no matter how this situation moves forward, NCDOT is committed to working alongside the community to determine the best path. Meanwhile, Charlotte City Council has called for a special meeting on Tuesday afternoon to talk about this project further. What are they planning for that meeting?
I think the special meeting was canceled already, I believe.
All right.
That was scheduled for Thursday. And it got a lot of rumors swirling that people thought maybe the CRBA had convinced someone to flip their vote and they were going to rescind the rescission. And that would have been just all hell broke loose. But I had J.D. Mazueta Arias on my podcast yesterday. It's to be on our site today. Just a little shameless plug. And he's told me that was actually his side of the story was that vote, that special meeting was called based on a motion 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, but council requested to have NCDOT come and present more info to them. Okay. So city staff was just following through with that motion despite Monday's vote. And then once they actually planned that meeting, everyone was like, well, why are we doing this? Send it to CARPO. It's CARPO's problem now, basically.
I'll say, you mentioned earlier, Ryan, that data centers are top of mind, and we've been talking about this for weeks, too, and it's a divisive issue, and it took center stage on Monday at the council meeting with members debating how to handle data center development. Councilwoman Lamona Mayfield wants more information on the cost of hosting data centers.
We're also recognizing that our state has created incentives for certain companies, which is putting a strain on our resources. We need to figure out a way for them to cover basically what is the cost of doing business in Charlotte versus cost to the residents.
In fact, some state leaders are on the same page when it comes to incentives for these facilities, including House Speaker Destin Hall.
I don't know that there needs to be an incentive to get more of them here. My take on it is big companies like that, they ought to pay the same tax as any other business that's beside of them and make it fair. And so whatever we need to do that, I'm fine with.
Again, although consideration of incentives, they don't seem to be the most pressing matter when it comes to data centers. It's their use of water and the fact that they consume vast amounts of power, and that has generally in the past allowed electricity rates for ratepayers to rise. Was that at all a part of this discussion, Ryan?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing, I think the biggest bugaboo, to use your word from earlier, the biggest problem in Charlotte or concern is nearness to residential properties. There was a presentation on Monday night about the 13 existing data centers, including those that have already been approved, and all of them are within 500 feet of a house. So as you said, the concerns are water usage, driving up energy prices, but also just like reports of loud humming coming from these data centers. Mm-hmm. The fact that almost all of them are near streams and what is getting discharged, even if you have what's called a closed loop system for the water that's cooling these data centers, eventually that, you know, that water needs to go somewhere and it needs to be kept out of water supply. So those are really the biggest concerns here in Charlotte among council members and their constituents.
Council also took up the topic of the returning of red light cameras on Monday night. They were here for a while years ago. They were removed because of costs. What's changed to make council consider them yet again, Ryan?
I think just a focus on sort of more traffic safety, Vision Zero, things that can have a measurable effect. You know, this has sort of been bounced around by folks. I remember Julie Eisel, when she was on council, used to talk about it a good bit and sort of inquire about it. So it's always sort of been on the back of people's minds. When can we afford to do it again? Because it has been done before in the turn of the millennium.
And they were removed in 2006 because a North Carolina court ruling required that most of the citation revenue should be sent to Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, which left the city with insufficient funds to support their operating costs. But now, as I understand it, there is a proposal that CMS run the program, something else for the schools to do, and then reimburse the city for expenses. But City Council's Ed Driggs isn't sure that lawmakers in Raleigh will go for that.
Hate to be negative, but I'm just saying the environment is such that I don't know about the politics of that.
What does that mean?
You know, I was wondering the same thing in terms of, I think the state is infamously just wants to sort of not allow the city to just do, I don't know, go beyond what it's already written into the law and the laws that the city would operate it and give the money to CMS, basically. So right now, the estimated cost of doing a one-year pilot program for these 10 locations that they've picked out, and this is still in committee, like you said, council hasn't made any decision or even discussed it yet as a full council, but it would be around $600,000 to run 10 spots, though some of that money would be recuperated.
So speaking of CMS, a couple of weeks ago, James, the Charlotte Mecklenburg School Board soundly rejected Superintendent Crystal Hill's $2.1 billion budget proposal, and they gave her a really short amount of time and very little input to make changes. Hill came back with her revised budget, and the board approved it unanimously. What changed?
Yeah, so in the grand scheme of things, not a lot changed. The big numbers are still the same. It's still a $2.1 billion budget. The operating budget is like $1.97 billion. What changed were more sort of kind of targeted tweaks that were based on a lot of the topics of discussion that we heard at those special hearings over the last couple weeks. So one of the big things, there's this program called Capturing Kids' Hearts that became a topic of conversation. It's a social emotional learning framework that's supposed to help build strong school environments, help kids with mental health, and like kind of educating the whole child beyond just academics. There had been some skepticism from board members about whether this program was effective, whether they had good data on it. And so the $2.4 million that had been allocated to that, that's gone from this budget, and it's going to be reallocated to other social emotional learning initiatives. So that's a big one. They moved around a couple teacher allotments. That was a big topic of conversation, you know, how teachers are placed at schools, especially with declining enrollment. They also saved four Department of Social Services liaison positions, and that had also become a big point of contention. In fact, a few people from the public came to the last board meeting to speak out and trying to save those positions. So just mostly minor tweaks.
Despite all the vagueness and the drama surrounding this budget, CMS Board Chair Stephanie Sneed reiterated that Crystal Hill's initial budget was not really far off, and she says that the last 2 weeks of work on the budget was worth the effort.
We should not be fighting over whether we fund mental health, whether we fund family engagement, whether we can move a teacher from one school to the other. The system is broken.
System is broken. What does that mean?
I think she's referring there to kind of what we were talking about earlier, some of the broader funding challenges that schools are facing, the fact that they have to lean so much more on the county. Those were all things that came up in these conversations over the last couple of weeks. You know, obviously there's been so much uncertainty without a state budget and teacher raises. Potentially that could be, you know, being undone now, but we still don't know all the full details. And I think maybe that was what she was hinting at, that sort of as we're kind of living in this environment where there's so much uncertainty from the higher levels of government, it creates these kinds of tensions locally.
Speaking of tension, the tension between the board and the superintendent during and following that initial budget presentation was palpable, and it was unusual. And that resulted in speculation about Crystal Hill having fallen out of favor with the board. And that speculation was further fueled by the emergency personnel issues meeting the board held this week. Again, school board chair Stephanie Sneed.
The board has confidence. There's nothing been expressed here at the dais that we know that this is a difficult cycle. And just because we had a difficult cycle doesn't necessarily mean any particular thing.
And on Wednesday afternoon, a CMS spokesperson told WFAE News that he wasn't aware of any changes to Hill's job. And in fact, you wrote an email, James, to the system, and they responded.
Yeah, we heard last night from CMS spokesperson who had responded to my inquiry. You know, after that special meeting, I had been hearing some speculation about the status of Hill's job. Certainly, it had been a really tough stretch, a lot of tension. There had been multiple special hearings, all based on personnel. But the spokesman tells me that Dr. Hill has, quote, no intentions of resigning. Rather, her focus remains steadfast on serving the students, staff, and community of CMS with unwavering dedication.
She has no intention of resigning. What does that mean?
So it sounds like she has no intention of resigning. So we'll have to see.
Let's read between the lines. Does that mean she's not going anywhere unless they say go away?
Correct. I think that there's maybe a flag being placed here that if anything were to happen, it would not be her decision. That's how I read that. Obviously, you played that clip before of Chair Sneed seeming to kind of downplay any idea of, you know, a lack of confidence from the board. But this certainly has been the tensest I've ever seen this board interact with Hill. And this is a board that over the last school year has really gotten along well, at least publicly, with Hill. You know, just in September, they celebrated historic academic gains. They gave her a raise and a contract extension just in December. So it was definitely a surprise to see kind of the quick turnaround, the very decisive vote against the budget, the very tense hearings. You know, so we're just gonna have to see what happens here.
Surprisingly, Ben, the South Carolina Supreme Court has overturned the murder conviction of Alex Murdaugh, the attorney convicted in 2023 of shooting and killing his wife and son, Maggie and Paul Murdaugh. Why?
Well, they said that he didn't get a fair trial. Basically, what it comes down to, the clerk of court down there in Colleton County had some engagement with the jurors that the state Supreme Court saw as improper and said that he deserved to have a retrial. I spoke to his defense attorney, Dick Harpootlian, this morning on air. He said they're planning to take this back and use new evidence that wasn't used in the first trial and find a fair jury down there in Walterboro and try this thing again.
Can he get it fair? There have been podcasts, there have been movies, there have been TV series about the family, about the murders, etc. Can he get a fair trial?
That's the very first thing I asked him. And he says he thinks it's still a possibility to find one in South Carolina.
And in that first trial, Dick Harpootlian talked about new evidence that the defense would bring. But in the first trial, the prosecution was allowed to enter evidence of previous financial crimes, which there was some pushback on. Will that be the case this time? Will they be allowed to do that this time? Or is that purely up to the discretion of whomever the judge ends up being?
It's going to end up being with that new judge, but I will say that's substantial because he's also in jail right now because of those financial crimes. And that was also part of the prosecutor's evidence for his motivation. So if you take that away, that's a big leg you take out from underneath them.
I only have about 10 seconds, but you told me that when you talked to Dick Harpootlian earlier this morning, that he told you that Mr. Murdaugh was surprised by this overturning of his conviction.
That's right. Incredulous, as he said.
Okay. Ben Thompson, anchor at WCNC-TV, Alexandria Sands for Axios Charlotte, Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve, and James Farrell from WFAE News. Thank you all.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.